TheBook.com.
Well, what's up, everybody? Thank you for joining me here on this Wednesday, July 27th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so as we go over all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me here on this hump day show. Over to be joined by Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds, the number one on Twitter, to talk about some PGA Championship stuff. Haven't heard from him yet this morning, and he's been, well, here he is now. But we will have Wes Reynolds here joining us in a couple seconds to look at the PGA Championship at Baltusrol. And then in the second half of today's show, Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com, break down UFC 201 in the middle. I'll give some Major League Baseball thoughts. We've got some interesting things to discuss here on today's show. So a lot of great stuff coming your way. Coming your way the rest of the week here on Bang the Book Radio on Thursday. We'll be joined by Aaron Saunders of BangTheBook.com, also of NumberFire.com. We'll take a look at the American Athletic Conference, the AAC, one of my favorite conferences in the country. A lot of interesting head coaches there in that league. So we'll talk about that with a season win total over, a season win total under, and some other thoughts on the other teams in that conference. Then also on Thursday, Jordan Bianchi of SB Nation will join us to chat some motorsports stuff, big NASCAR weekend coming up here. And then on Friday, the Bettors Box, our final edition of the Bettors Box for this season, because we're going back to the 5 1-hour shows next week for the month of August as we get you geared up for the football season. So go ahead and bring in today's first guest. That is Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds, the number one on Twitter. Wes, how's it going today, sir?
Adam, going well. How about yourself, man?
Doing very well. No complaints from me. We've got another major to talk about. It feels like we've talked about a lot of majors here lately, but that's what happens when you get this condensed schedule because of the Olympics.
Yeah, it's everything's kind of come up fast, and you know, it's been a pretty different schedule for sure. Usually we're talking about this tournament in mid-August, but very interesting to see how the schedule has shaped out this year.
Well, and this track here at Baltusrol in Springfield, New Jersey, first time that this course has held the PGA Championship since 2005. So it's been a while. A lot of these guys don't really have a whole lot of familiarity with this course. What can you tell us about what the players face this week?
Well, it's a pretty long course. It's only a par 70 this week, but it's 7,400 plus yards. So it is a long course by that standard. It's a very interesting setup the way it's done because the front nine is only a par 34, but the back nine is a par 36. These players won't see a par five until the 17th hole. The two par fives on the course are actually the last two holes on the course, 17 and 18. So it plays par 72 for the members of the club, but it also only pays it also is only going to be a par 70 for the pros this week. Poa-Anua greens with bet grass with Poa-Anua, so it's faster greens on the stem. Probably is going to be about 13 plus, unlike what we saw at Troon. If you look back to 2005, the average score was 72.45, so it ranked the third most difficult course of that season. It's a tree-lined course, not a lot of water on it, but a lot of fairway bunkers, long and accurate tee shots. I mean, that pretty much works on every course, but the greens are very slick, as I was saying earlier. So, you know, it should be a pretty big test. Not sure how much the weather is going to play. I mean, it could maybe soften it up a little bit. But this is one of those PGAs that I think play a little bit more like a U.S. Open than like a PGA. I think the winning score at most places was set at about 8 or 8.5 under for 4 days. And that's where I think it's about going to be. I don't think it's going to get much. If it's going to go better than 8.5, it probably, I don't think, is going to go much more than 10 under par for 4 days.
Well, and of course, the winning score in 2005, as you mentioned, a lot of players regularly shot over par there in that event, was 4 under. That belonged to Phil Mickelson, the second lowest winning score since 2004. The lowest winning score, 3 under at Oakland Hills. That was Patty Harrington in 2008. So, you know, we'll have to see how this course does play. As you mentioned, weather could be a little bit of a factor. They got some pretty soaking rains earlier in the week, kind of softened things up a little bit. Some rain forecasted here for Friday night, for Friday, also into Saturday, then maybe a chance of some rain on Sunday as well. So, you know, in terms of rain here, I mean, it may stop a little bit of the carry on the fairways, but you know, it's going to help a lot of players in terms of approach shots to the green, right?
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, you know, the setup is not going to be like a birdie fest, though, and I think the greens are still going to be really fast. So, I mean, you can't expect them to go, I don't think, too low. I don't know if we're going to see a deluge here where, you know, like what we saw with Rory McIlroy a few years ago at Congressional. Could, but I don't foresee that.
Well, the Big Four has kind of become a little bit of a Big Five this week. You've actually right now at DSI Sportsbook got Rory McIlroy, the favorite, plus 785, Dustin Johnson, plus 815, Jason Day, plus 1100. We'll talk about him here in a couple minutes. Henrik Stenson, who, of course, won the Open Championship at Troon, plus 1450, and then Jordan Spieth, plus 1650. So not a whole lot of love for Spieth here this week. He hasn't really done a whole lot outside of that Masters collapse and then the win at Colonial. But, you know, among McIlroy and Johnson, I mean, I've seen a lot of people like both of these guys here this week. Chance that Rory, you know, wins his third PGA, really gets that win that he's looking for this year. If you had to pick between one of the two top horses, which one are you going with?
I probably would go with Rory simply because, you know, nobody, I think, does better against really soft, wet golf courses, if that's what this becomes, then Rory does. And, I mean, I can see Johnson obviously fits here. He's got the most wins on Ben Grass and Poa Anua Mixed Green since 2008 with 5. So, you know, Rory would be the guy, though, that I would probably go with in terms of the Big Four if I had to do that. And I may end up doing that with some matchups. Some of these prices have gotten up a little big. I mean, I liked Rory over Spieth early in the week, but that line has moved about 50 cents on the matchup. So that's probably one I'd have to take a pass on at this point.
Like I said, Jason Day around plus 1,100, and we've got Jason Day reaching out to the media again with some issues prior to this major as well. It seems like that's been something that he's kind of brought up in his, you know, pre-tournament media scrum every time we've had a major here this year. Now talking about his kids being sick, his wife being admitted to the ER. Is Day a guy that you're going to look to fade based on these things? Or, you know, is the way that he's played in some of these other majors kind of, you know, render that null and void in terms of he's had distractions going into other tournaments this year?
I don't know if I'm really looking to fade him. I'm not necessarily looking to play him. I mean, there's always a little bit of drama, I guess, with Jason Day. I mean, the guy's always hurt. Something's always happened. So, you know, sometimes I don't know if that's, you know, him kind of trying to play the media a little bit, or if you're basically, you know, or if that's just the way it is. But, I mean, it's not really – I think the price is a little short based on, you know, kind of how he played last week. He's obviously certainly capable, but, you know, he's not a guy I'm necessarily looking to back this week.
One guy that didn't make your cut, but he's sitting there at 20-1, Phil Mickelson. Of course, Phil, a tremendous weekend at Troon and still didn't win the tournament, still looking for that first win since the 2013 Open Championship. He's at 20-1 this week, as I mentioned. He won this event in 2005 when the PGA Championship was here. Any love for Phil this week, or is this, you know, maybe a course that in his earlier days he could conquer, but maybe not now?
Well, Phil is a guy that I think sets up well for this course. I mean, being that he won it in 2005, the last PGA Championship, but I think the price is a little short. I would have liked to have seen a little bit better. I think because of how he played at Troon, you're not getting the value you ordinarily would. He's a guy that plays very well. And one of the angles that I looked at with some of the guys I played this week, he plays well on A.W. Tillinghast Designs, which Baltusrol, of course, is. But if you look at comparable courses that Tillinghast has designed, Beth Page Black, where you've had the Barclays and the U.S. Open, and he's contended there. Firestone, which is where the WGC Bridgestone Invitational is in Akron every year. Medina, where the 2012 Ryder Cup is. Wingfoot, which has hosted the U.S. Open. And then Ridgewood, which hosts the Barclays once every 4 years. It's kind of in that four-year rotation in New York, New Jersey. So he's got a pretty good record on those courses. I just think that the price, I would like a little bit better, but it would not shock me to see Phil play well.
Well, of course, one of our favorite things to look at here in these big tournaments, especially here in majors, where you've got the big four, and as I mentioned, Stenson kind of sneaking in there as a big five this week, you wind up getting a lot of value on some very, very good players. You've got several of them on your card here this week. Sergio Garcia, Justin Rose, Matt Kuchar, Brandon Grace, Patrick Reed, a guy that seems to set up pretty well for this course. Well, we'll start with Sergio, who, you know, obviously a guy that can get it out there, can shorten this course a little bit. His price at 25-1 this week, what do you like about him?
I think Sergio's playing some of the best golf of his career right now. If you look at his last three starts, fifth at Troon, fifth at the BMW International, fifth at the U.S. Open, also has a win at the Byron Nelson. And I don't think you want to be a slave necessarily to this angle, but one stat that I found this week was that 14 of the last 16 PGA champions, the winners of the PGA Championship, 88%, had won a tournament earlier in the season prior to the PGA, which Sergio obviously has at the Byron Nelson. And, you know, he's playing great golf, and I think him and Henrik Stenson are actually very good friends. And Henrik Stenson kind of finally got that major at Troon, and I think that could be a motivating thing for Sergio, too, you know, to see his good buddy, I mean, who's a good enough friend to where he showed up to and kept his commitment to Sergio's charity event, which was held in Switzerland the day after the Open at Troon. So, you know, I mean, Sergio got a better feel for that event than the Olympics probably have in Rio. So I think he's in a positive frame of mind. I think he's comfortable with where he is in the game. And, you know, maybe that takes a little bit of pressure off of him, and he just goes out and plays. And, you know, and I think that's when he's at his best, when he just goes out and plays and doesn't think about it too much.
Well, Sergio has had a couple of close calls in the PGA Championship before. He was the runner-up in 1999 when Tiger Woods won his first one, and then Garcia also the runner-up there at Oakland Hills in 2008, the one I mentioned earlier that Patty Harrington won at 3-under. So Sergio's played pretty well on some very tough PGA Championship courses, so I think that's a look that certainly makes some sense here this week. A guy that's kind of become a little bit of an afterthought, even though he's a very, very good player, 35-year-old Justin Rose. He makes your card here this week at about 33-1.
Yeah, and I think with Rose a little bit this year, he had some back issues earlier in the year, but I think he's healthy now. Played solid at Troon. He's a guy that's proven he can win on tough courses. Marion is, of course, from 2013 at the U.S. Open, is not a Tillinghast design, but there's a little bit of overlap and some similarities between the courses, and he won that tournament at one over par. So he's a guy that I think is more of a grinder type. And also, if you look at that Tillinghast angle that I talked about, played at the Ryder Cup at the Medina, and he was one of Europe's better players. Went 3-2, which had, you know, not a perfect record by any stretch, but was able to beat Phil Mickelson and kind of turn that tie for Europe on Sunday, and I think really put them in position to win that Ryder Cup 4 years ago. So he's familiar with the designs. I think, you know, he's a guy that kind of gets looked past, but somehow he's going to be there.
And I think that kind of speaks to his price as well, where he is sort of one of those, as I said, basically an afterthought type of guy. But yet here he is, you know, in that 35-1 mix, in the price range of Adam Scott, Ricky Fowler, a guy that, you know, can really swing it on a course like this. So I think that, you know, is a really good tip there by you. Matt Kuchar, this is a guy that you've been on quite a bit here. He's been really disappointing in the majors so far, 46th in both the Open Championship and the U.S. Open. But in terms of other events, 9th at Glen Abbey last week in the Canadian Open, 3rd at the Bridgestone, 4th at the Memorial. So he's played well, except for in these majors. Is this a case where you like the way this course sets up for him? Or is it one of those that you've talked about in the past where, you know, when you leave a guy off that you've been on, all of a sudden he's going to wind up winning one?
Maybe it's a little bit of both. And I'll lump Reed in with this too. Kuchar, 8 top tens this year. Patrick Reed, 6 top tens. Kuchar has won on these courses before, or he's won at Ridgewood, which is a similar course. He won the Barclays back several years ago at Ridgewood, and also was 3rd at the Firestone event earlier this year. So I think he's familiar with the course. 3 third place finishes overall this year. So, you know, Kuchar is certainly a guy that, you know, he's getting close, and I don't know. I mean, some people will say, you know, I believe in the do factor or I don't believe in the do factor, but I think there's a little bit more raw data that can back Kuchar this year. And then with Reed, I felt he probably played the best major of his career, even though he only ended up finishing 12th. He was up there, you know, before the two main compatriots at that event got away from the field, kind of last field. But they came back, you know, he was, you know, 2nd after the first round, hung in there, ended up only finishing 12th, but probably deserved better. But I think, you know, he can take some confidence from that. So, that's why those two definitely make the card.
You got a couple of guys at 55-1 here. One of them I think is a really, really golden price, and that's Brandon Grace, who was 72nd in the Open Championship at Troon, shot 13 over, but before that, back-to-back top 10s, including a 5th at Oakmont, where he shot a third round 66. And Brandon Grace is a guy that, you know, earlier in the year, we were looking at prices for this guy in the 25-28, 30, 35-1 range, something like that. Is there some recency bias inflating this price based on how poorly he played at the Open?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes it's kind of a prisoner of the moment syndrome, if you will. And I think you're getting a guy with great value here that was in the 30-some-to-1 range for the Open Championship. And here he was a guy that I think got backed in the moment. In the tournament over at Troon, and he disappointed. So sometimes you'll see that. You'll see, you know, somebody get backed, and then they don't come in for you, and they really underperform, and then you want to get away from them, and you get away from them too soon. He was in the bad end of the draw over in the Open, got the worst of the wind, got the worst of the weather, and I think that's partially why, and it got him behind. And then when you get behind, you have to take chances, and you end up kind of, you know, it ends up kind of just adding and snowballing to less than stellar play. But I think you still have a guy here that was 5th at the U.S. Open, 10th at Firestone, was 3rd at the PGA last year at Whistling Straits, 5th at the Open at U.S. Open at Chambers Bay last year. So, I mean, you're getting a guy that has played really, really well in big tournaments and is knocking on that door. And to get him, I think, at this better price is really good this week, and I would expect him to play very well.
You got a couple of past PGA champions on your list here. A couple of guys in the triple digit range. You've got Jason Duffner about 100-1 out there. And then also Keegan Bradley around 125-1 in terms of when these guys won. Bradley won in 2011 in a playoff over Jason Duffner. And then Duffner a couple of years later in 2013 picked up the win at Oak Hill in Rochester. Is this an angle where you're looking for past PGA champions, or does this course set up well for those two guys?
You know, not necessarily. I think Duffner has kind of had a little bit of a resurgence this year. With his win at the Career Builder out in Palm Springs, and he had kind of fallen off after going through some personal problems. But I think, you know, he's been back. He's been consistent. He was eighth at Oakmont for the U.S. Open. Played fairly well at the at Troon. He's a guy that's not really played well over in the British Open, and you know, played solid. Only finished 22nd, but you know, he's a guy that I think is worth a shot. His major win was up at Oak Hill in Rochester, so it was an East Coast course, and so I think, you know, this is a guy that, you know, could kind of be a little bit under the radar this week. Bradley was a guy that really stood out to me this week, because comes off a solid finish at Troon, was 18th, probably should have finished better, but had a very rough Sunday. Bradley, of course, you know, has gone through a caddy change with his longtime caddy. So, you know, he's been kind of hit and miss this year. You see him, he's missed a couple. There's times he's missed 2-3 cuts in a row, but he's got a really great record on these Tillinghast courses. Of course, his win at Firestone in 2012 was second after he won the PGA the year before, was second in 2013, also at Firestone. And he and Phil Mickelson, you know, found some magic at Medina back in 2012. They were unbeaten in their partnerships together, and I think Bradley ended up going 3-1 for the week. His only loss was the loss to Rory McIlroy in the singles on Sunday, and you know, it was to the point where they were so hot where Davis Love, you know, kind of went with Phil's advice and decided to sit him out, and that might have turned the Ryder Cup if he sent them back out there, because they were just destroying guys as a partnership there. So I think Bradley, you know, with his length and his past success on these courses, you know, should be good here as well. And another one that I kind of took that was a little bit longer shot at 125-1 along with Bradley was Scott Piercy. Piercy missed the cut at Troon. So a lot of people, you know, are kind of getting away from him because he got a little bit of backing over there, even though there wasn't really any evidence that or past performance that indicated he was going to play well across the pond. But you're getting a guy at 125-1 that finished second at Firestone and second at the U.S. Open. So, you know, he's a guy clearly that I think is good form. And I think, you take the Open over there, I think you take that as a little bit more of an outlier. You don't want to completely ignore it, but you don't want to just say, okay, this is where his game is. And, you know, he didn't play the Canadian Open last week where he had won that event before. So, you know, that tells me, you know, he did a little bit of work and on his game and maybe got a little rest and think he's going to outperform that 125-1 for sure.
One of the things I want our listeners to keep in mind when you're looking at recent results, we talk about Jason Duffner finishing 22nd there at the Open Championship, but you had six guys at one under, four more guys at even par, and then Duffner at plus one. He winds up being 22nd, even though he was only two shots behind the guys that finished 12th. So keep that in mind here with a lot of these golf leaderboards, because all those guys that tie with the same score, you know, of course, taking up spots, and then the guys that are a shot or two back, you know, kind of tend to fall down the board a little bit. So keep that in mind as you're looking at some of the recent results. One other guy I want to touch on here, a guy that has been around a long time. In fact, he played his first major in 1993. That was the U.S. Open. Steve Stricker, who In his last six PGA Championship starts, no finishes worse than 30th, and he's got a couple top 10s in there as well.
Yeah, Stricker is a guy that, because of his age, because he's going to be approaching Champions Tour age, we kind of forget about a little bit. But and he doesn't play as frequently because of injuries, and he is a family man and, you know, cut back his schedule a little bit. But this is a guy that went fourth at Royal Troon and then went and has a had a 21st the week before that at the DC event, Flick and Loans. Also, you know, finished second at the tied for second at the FedEx St. Jude Classic. So all of a sudden, Steve Stricker is kind of, you know, found his game a little bit again. He's not playing every single week, but, you know, three straight pretty solid finishes. And another guy that's never won a major that, you know, just has had different priorities. Kind of reminds me of Bruce Litsky back in the day, where Bruce Litsky would be a guy that wouldn't play for about 2 or 3 months and then pull the clubs out of the ground and shoot a 66. I mean, and that reminds me of Stricker. And Stricker has, for a long time, been one of the better putters on tour. I mean, to the point where Tiger Woods and all the other elite players went to him for putting tips. I mean, he's kind of like a putting guru. And he's a guy that I think will be prepared for the slick greens. Usually plays pretty well in the summer, because it used to be you could just, you know, draw a check mark next to his name when he was playing the John Deere Classic, which is going to be coming up here in a couple of weeks. So, you know, I think getting triple digits on him, you know, there are worse flyers to take a shot at for sure.
Well, a lot of great insight here from Wes on the PGA Championship. One final thing I want to ask you about, more from a matchup standpoint. Are there any angles that you're looking to play here with the matchups that you can leave our listeners with for this week?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I try not to put the matchups in terms of like my futures, and, you know, because essentially that's like doubling down, because there's sometimes where I took a future on somebody and then I might play against them in a matchup, because it's a completely different bet. So, you know, just because you might have put a future on me, because with futures you're looking more at prices too, necessarily, and just taking numbers rather than, okay, well, I think this guy is going to win. You know, you're taking, you know, good odds on something. You know, that's like, you know, with me taking Keegan Bradley, like, I don't really think he's going to win, but I think you're getting a good number. So with angles, with matchups, you know, you're looking for some correlation, but I don't think that you can go completely off a futures board correlation here. And I mean, I'm looking, you know, at some of the guys that are obviously in good form, guys that have put consistent finishes together of late. I mean, that's really kind of what I'm looking at there in terms of matchups. The one future guy that I play that I didn't mention, though, I should get to is Brent Snedeker. The angle on Snedeker is that he rebounds off close losses, and he's a guy that's kind of streaky. He puts several good finishes together. He goes on them little mini runs. You saw that this year with losing in the playoff at the Sony, and then responding the next week winning at Torrey Pines. Did it back in 2012 too, winning the Tour Championship off second and sixth in a couple FedEx Cup events. And Snedeker was the guy that looked like he was in a position to win last Sunday and wasn't able to get the job done. But he's a guy that I think could play well this week, and one of the better putters on tour. So I think he'll be prepared for the slick greens.
And Snedeker in that 55 or 60 to 1 range there, along with Brandon Grace. Wes Reynolds, a lot of excellent insight from you here on the PGA Championship. Thank you so much for joining us at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter. Wes, we'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, thanks, buddy.
Great stuff there on the PGA Championship. Of course, the last major of the golf season but we do have the Olympics coming up, and then, of course, the FedEx Cup playoffs. So a lot of great events still on the horizon from a PGA Tour, from a PGA Tour standpoint. We'll be right back after a quick note from DSI Sportsbook.
This segment of Bang the Book Radio is brought to you by BetDSI Sportsbook. DSI is one of the industry leaders in customer service, wagering options, and is offering Bang the Book listeners a $10 free betting account just for signing up. Simply sign up with the promo code BANG10. Again, that's BANG10 and get $10 free today at BetDSI.
Make sure you head on over there to DSI Sportsbook. Also, with that Bang10 promo code, you get a 50 to 100% deposit bonus based on the amount that you deposit with after getting that initial $10 free bet. Just use the promo code Bang10 over there at DSI Sportsbook. Bang300 still works, even though they no longer support poker software. But Bang300 down to a 200% deposit bonus, 100% for the sportsbook, also 100% for the live casino. Take a quick look at the Major League Baseball side of things here. I wrote up most of the reasonable numbers in my picks and analysis piece over at bangthebook.com today, so you can check all of those out. One game I do want to mention here on the show, we've got the Los Angeles Angels taking on the Kansas City Royals. Royals really falling off the face of the earth in a big way. Blown out 13-0 yesterday by Anaheim. Great pitching performance there from Tyler Skaggs and his return to the major leagues from Tommy John surgery. But tonight you've got a very interesting game because you've got Danny Duffy. And both these guys have been on quite a run here of late. Shoemaker started throwing his splitter a lot more. All of a sudden things really took off for him. He's more than a scout per inning now, 115 Ks and 112 and two-thirds innings. Danny Duffy, now that he's in a starting role after working out of the bullpen for a while, in 76 and two-thirds innings, a 317 ERA, a 223, 281, 405 slash against, 84 strikeouts in those 76 and two-thirds innings against just 15 walks. The problem for Duffy's been the long ball. He's given up 12 of them as a starter, but a lot of them with the bases empty. He's given up 8 of his 13 home runs with nobody on base. Solo home runs don't really hurt you a whole lot. So both of these guys in a pretty nice groove here, but we've seen money come in against the Royals. This number was in the minus 125, minus 120 range. Now Duffy at minus 110. So the market coming in on the Angels, who have played a little bit better here of late. Now they're obviously not going to contend too much in the American League West, but things going a little bit better for them here. They've rattled off 8 of their last 11. And in fact, in the month of July, they're 13-8. So things kind of turning a little bit. And again, I talk about this all the time. You want to play against extremes. The Angels were 8-19 in the month of June. They're not a good team, but they're certainly not a team with a winning percentage below 30% for a long stretch of time. So here in July, they've won about 62% of their games going 13-8. Again, you want to play against those extremes because that's where you're going to find value. You know, once the market starts to shift one way, sometimes you want to go against the grain and shift the other way, and then you can start making some money that way. But seems to be a little bit of the case here where we've got people coming in on Anaheim who's playing well, coming in against Kansas City who's not playing well at all. I don't necessarily have any thoughts on this game, but I just wanted to break down the line move for you a little bit there. I don't know how sustainable it is for both of these guys to have this type of performance over a large sample size. But you do have two guys that are pitching pretty well right now. So you can either ride the hot hand or you can look to fade the hot hand. And I think that either one of those options honestly makes sense. Of course, one of them will win and one of them won't. But, I think that when you've got two pitchers going in the same direction, maybe sometimes you want to ride the wave. So I don't know how you want to play this game. It's completely up to you. I wish I had a stronger opinion on it, but I do have some stronger opinions over in that picks and analysis piece. A couple of things I want to mention here regarding the National League East. And I retweeted something from the pitcher list who used to do a lot of great work with GIF files until Major League Baseball shut them down a little bit. But it was a chart of Noah Syndergaard's velocity last night from brooksbaseball.net, which is where a lot of PitchFX data comes from. It's not good. It's not good at all. About halfway through his outing, Syndergaard's velocity really started to drop off in a very big way. We know that he's pitching hurt. We know that he's pitching with that bone spur. The Mets are not a very good offensive team this year. Got a very good bullpen. Of course, the starting rotation is fantastic, but they need Syndergaard. They're still without Zach Wheeler. You know, Steven Matz also pitching with a bone spur in his elbow, according to reports. Bartolo Colon's going to fall off in the second half because he's 4,900 years old or whatever he is now. He's actually 43. So you know, for the Mets, they need Syndergaard to be good. So, you know, at this point in time, I mean, you look at the Miami Marlins, who have an issue of their own with Wei-Yin Chen, dealing with a sprained elbow. We'll see if that ends up becoming Tommy John surgery. Anytime you're talking about sprain and elbow, it's not good. So we'll see what happens with Chen. At least that explains why Chen's been so bad this season. But this is an injury situation that will affect both teams, because you've got the Mets, who are a half game behind the Marlins in the East, 53-46. If there's something seriously wrong with Noah Syndergaard, and generally in-game velocity drops to that extent are a very bad sign, the Mets could be in a little bit of trouble here, and the Marlins could be the team to pick up the pace. Now, the Marlins looking at Jeremy Hellickson of the Phillies, seems like they're going to try and add him here for the push. He'll kind of slot in there and replace Wei-Yin Chen. Obviously, they would like to have Wei-Yin Chen, given some of the options that they're going with here at the back end of the rotation. But you know, the Marlins, really, to be 54-46 here, four games out in the East, and to control their own destiny for a wild card spot, it's kind of stunning, given that Giancarlo Stanton was off to a very slow start here. Wei-Yin Chen has done nothing. Jose Fernandez, you know, has been very good, but he missed a couple of starts earlier in the year. So, you know, for the Marlins, I think that this is about the best case scenario. And if they can be a buyer here at the deadline, pick up some pieces and parts, you know, we'll see what happens with them. But they're going to have to hold off the Cardinals and I believe the Pirates, who I think, you know, are still a team that you can back here, you know, in the coming weeks to be a team that should take some major steps forward. So, you know, the National League wildcard picture is getting very, very interesting because you've got several teams within 2.5 games. You got the Dodgers, who lead it now at 57-44. You got the Marlins for 54-46, who would be in that wildcard game. Mets are a half game out. Cardinals are a game out. Pirates are 2.5 back. So, a lot of teams looking to buy here in that National League race. We'll have to see how things play out with the trade deadline as we get closer to Monday. But I wanted to bring up that Syndergaard thing because that's something that, you know, you really want to watch very, very closely over his next few starts. I would not back him. I would either fade him or I would, you know, just stay off the game altogether. But you really want to watch those velocity charts for Syndergaard because that's a major, major red flag when you get a velocity drop of that nature in the middle of a start. We'll shift gears here away from Major League Baseball. Bring in Jay Primetown of MMAOddsBreaker.com. We'll talk a little bit about UFC 201. Jay, how's it going today, man?
Going great. We got a bit of a heat wave for much of the United States, and what better way to, you know, hit a heat wave than to go to Hotlanta for UFC 201?
And I was reaching out to you a little bit here, trying to see, you know, what your take was on the card. For me, for my very untrained eyes, it seems like it's not a card loaded with talent, but there is definitely some intrigue here in a lot of these matchups.
Yeah, I think this pay-per-view's kind of gone under the radar for sure, with how much emphasis they put on UFC 200. And now with the emphasis they put on UFC 202 with the McGregor-Diaz rematch and all the fights that they put on there, they definitely didn't do the same due diligence with putting together a really impressive card here. Sure, there's certainly some important fights, but it definitely doesn't have the star power or the name recognition that, you know, the bookends of this UFC 201 had to offer.
Well, at least we do have a title fight on this card between Robbie Lawler and Tyron Woodley in the welterweight division. We'll get to that fight here in a little bit. This one on UFC Fight Pass, also Fox Sports 2, and then the main card on the pay-per-view side. We'll begin with the Fight Pass segment, as we usually do here, three fights on that. Any of those really stand out to you from a betting standpoint?
I kind of like Ryan Benoit in the flyweight fight. He's a modest underdog, or at least he opened as a modest underdog, where Freddie Serrano, a big age difference. And Benoit has proven in the past to be a very durable type of fighter. He can take a good amount of punishment. He had a really nice surprise win over Anthony Pettis' brother, Sergio Pettis, not too long ago either. Serrano came from that one of the tough Latin America seasons, and just you know, certainly talented from a wrestling perspective. I believe he competed in the Olympics for Colombia in wrestling, but from an MMA standpoint, he's still rather green and a bit aged. So I think Benoit here is, you know, the more complete MMA fighter. And I think that's the way to go in this one. It's certainly not, you know, a guaranteed type of situation, but I do think there are some advantages here for him. And I think the line should be flipped. He should be a small favorite.
I did think it was really interesting to get a 36-year-old there in Serrano with only 3 professional MMA fights under his belt. And, of course, as you mentioned, you know, he's been wrestling in the Olympics before for his native Colombia. But still, you know, I mean, it's a much different type of animal here. And then I imagine he's in supreme physical condition even at 36. But still, you know, as you get deeper into a fight, and generally you can correct me if I'm wrong here, a lot of times these flyweight fights, you know, it's sort of hit or miss whether there's going to be a stoppage win or if it's just going to be one of those ones that kind of gradually goes to the cards.
Yeah, I mean, typically, you know, it's definitely not a science, but the lower the weight, the less likely there is going to be a finish. So at heavyweight, you see more finishes, and then at flyweight, you see the least amount of finishes of any weight class. That's typically how it works, and that kind of makes sense. Though you think the bigger the person, the more power that they have in their striking, then the more likely they are to be able to finish a fight. You know, submissions obviously play a part in that as well, but you know, from a power and a striking and a knockout perspective, definitely flyweight would be the least likely to see a finish. I mean, there are late bloomers in MMA careers. Daniel Cormier is a great example of a guy who came over from the wrestling and, you know, really didn't pick up the sport until he turned 30 years old and really turned it on, you know, just the last couple of years, and to be one of the top fighters in the world. So there are late bloomers, but that's harder to do at the smaller weight classes as well. Speed is such a big component of this weight class. All the fighters can move and move so extremely quickly. And, you know, the older you get, you know, the speed is one of the first things to go.
We'll move over to the Fox Sports 2 portion of the card. We've got some very familiar names here on this part of the card. We got a heavyweight fight between Anthony Hamilton and Damian Grabowski. Ross Pearson and Jorge Masvidal are of course, guys that, you know, have been around for a long time. Any really good wagering angles coming out of this preliminary part of the card?
I like Hamilton over Grabowski. I've been kind of using this angle a bit in some, you know, in the, over the last 3-4 months with heavyweights, is that I look to fade the smaller heavyweights, the guys that are only weighing, you know, 220 to 240, that type of thing. Hamilton is right near the end of the weight at, you know, 260 to 265, and Grabowski is, you know, much smaller than that, you know, 230, 240. So on fight day, you're looking at a guy who's going to be, you know, 25, 30 pounds heavier. That's a big, big advantage in this type of fight. I really like the heavier guy, the bigger guy, you know, to control the fight, score takedowns. And, you know, when that happens, he's going to be able to win, because it's going to be very difficult for the lower-weighted guy to be able to get up. In Grabowski's last fight, he fought Derek Lewis, certainly, you know, quite a bit better than Anthony Hamilton, but a similar scenario where Lewis comes in right at the end of that weight, 265 mark, and Grabowski had no way to get him to the ground. And once he was, you know, put on the ground, Grabowski, he had no answers for Lewis's ground and pound. So I think we could see something similar here from Anthony Hamilton. Hamilton could potentially get the finish, you know, probably does. So I think that's a pretty decent betting angle. Pearson and Masvidal, that's a bit of a tough fight to call, just because Masvidal likes to find himself in really close competitive striking matchups. Really talented fighter, but he's one of those guys that always tends to be in close decisions. So I think that's a buyer beware if you're looking to play Jorge Masvidal there. Both guys pretty durable. I expect a competitive striking matchup. So I think this one hits the card. So you can definitely look to parlay the ghost of decision in that fight.
You know, in looking at Pearson here, this is already his third fight of 2016, and I think we're just a little bit past the halfway point now of the year. He fought January 17th, also on March 19th. A lot of times we talk about guys with longer layoffs. Maybe they're off for 18 months rehabbing an injury, or you know, something happens and a fight gets scratched. Maybe they get popped for a banned substance, or the opponent does, and then they you know, kind of get pushed to the back of the line a little bit. But in terms of Pearson here, again, his third fight already in a little bit over 7 months. You know, is that something that you look to play on, play against? Do you have any sort of feel for that?
I think it really depends on where and just how much damage they take in those fights. You know, he fought in March, so this is now going to be almost August. So it's April, May, June, July. So you're talking about three and a half months. You know, that's not too far out of the realm of, you know, the typical rotation of, you know, about three fights a year. So that doesn't really bother me much. Masvidal has been active as well. He's been frustrated by the fact that he keeps getting in these close decisions and keeps wanting to get back in the cage to right the ship. But it keeps that the whole, just the way he fights continues to play out the same way that, you know, these really close competitive bouts. Neither guy has taken a ton of damage in their recent fights. So I'm expecting both guys to come in, you know, pretty healthy and, you know, for it to be pretty competitive.
So in that flyweight fight, is it Wilson Reese or Wilson Rice?
Hayes. He's Brazilian, so the R is silent. It's turned to an H. That's how that mostly works with the Brazilian fighters.
All right, perfect. So Wilson Hayes takes on Hector Sandoval here, and he was supposed to originally fight Demetrius Johnson here at this event. Now he winds up facing Sandoval, and you know, I mean, it's a really tough spot for these MMA fighters because this is, you know, kind of a lose-lose type of situation, because if you lose this fight, you're obviously not supposed to. And if you win this fight, it doesn't really mean a whole lot, because initially, you know, you were supposed to take on a much tougher challenger, and in this case, you know, a guy that's a champion. So for Hayes, I mean, do you know, what kind of outcome do you expect from him here as almost a $3 favorite?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. This is definitely a lose-lose spot. You know, it's a letdown situation because he was scheduled to fight Demetrius Johnson, and they didn't have an opponent, you know, as a replacement until, you know, a few weeks ago. It's been less than a month since they've announced Sandoval will be fighting Wilson Hayes here. So different type of opponent. Mentally, obviously, it's hard to get up for this fight because if you win, it really means not much because he's already locked into fighting the winner of a future tough season in December. So Johnson's scheduled to fight in December. I don't know if Johnson's going to fight before then. And so this is a difficult situation. So what's Hayes really fighting for in this bout? Even if he wins, he may not fight again for another year, potentially for the championship. And Sandoval comes out of Team Alpha Male, trains with Uriah Faber, Joseph Benavidez, all those guys, those sub 145 pounders at Alpha Male. So it's a really competitive camp. He's 30 years of age himself. He hits hard. He kind of has the Team Alpha Male mentality, you know, bit of a wrestler brawler, good offensive wrestler, seems pretty confident, fights at a decent pace. So this isn't an easy fight at all for Hayes. I'm curious to see how Sandoval does on the short notice. You know, we've seen this a lot now, short notice, fighting really well for a round and then, you know, having conditioning issues as the fight progresses. So that's definitely a question mark. I certainly wouldn't look to play Hayes at the current price. Sandoval does hit hard. Hayes is getting older. Could he get clipped here? Certainly possible. And Sandoval is definitely going to make it into a brawl. So, you know, when that type of situation happens, you know, crazy things happen is my point. So it wouldn't be a surprise too much to me if Sandoval does get a surprise win. This, like I said, this is definitely a letdown spot for Wilson Hayes.
Another flyweight fight here, Ian McCall, Justin Scoggins. Is McCall still rocking that Snidely Whiplash mustache, or has he gotten rid of that?
Oh, yeah. Definitely playing the mustache card.
That thing is beautiful. I mean, that's a wagering angle right there in and of itself. But this is a guy that hasn't fought since UFC 183 on January 31st. So, again, one of those guys with about an 18-19 month layoff. Deservedly, he's an underdog in the plus 195 range, but is he a live dog despite that layoff?
Yeah, this is a tough one because Ian McCall at his best You know, not too many years ago, he fought Demetrius Johnson, and many thought he won the fight or it should have been a draw. He lost that fight, and Johnson ended up becoming the flyweight champion and has been the only flyweight champion in the UFC. So, but the problem with McCall is that he's only 32 years of age, but he's been fighting forever. His body just hasn't been able to keep up. He's got all sorts of issues with his arm and his hand. He can't even – one of his hands, I forget if it's his right or left off the top of my head, but he can't even close the fist, which is really problematic. And he's been battling all sorts of injury issues. And especially in this weight class, speed certainly, you know, the biggest component, and just moving around and, you know, being competitive is going to be a challenge for McCall here. He's a great veteran fighter. He usually has a really, really good game plan. But he's facing a young up-and-comer in Scoggins, only 24 years of age. He's ranked 13th, but I think he's, in terms of talent, he's probably in the top six or seven in this weight class. He trains with Stephen Thompson, the number one contender in the welterweight division. And they kind of have, you know, a fairly similar style, a lot of unorthodox leg kicks, constant movement. It's very difficult to game plan for because there's not that many guys who kind of provide that kind of offensive skill set. And Scoggins has himself, you know, really, really gotten a lot better with his defensive wrestling. His last few fights have been against wrestlers for the most part, and he did a really good job in his last fight throwing his opponent, Ray Borg, who's, you know, got really, really athletic offensive wrestler, and gave him his first loss and did so decisively. So I think Ian McCall is really in for a difficult fight here. And I think this is a fight that Scoggins is going to win. It's the fight that the UFC wants to put him over and to push him into the top five now weight class and make him a contender for Demetrius Johnson to fight him potentially in 2017.
So are you looking for a stoppage there? I mean, is that the way that you would play it, or maybe by decision?
I don't think you could play. I think it's got to be by decision. McCall is super, super durable. He's the guy who fought John Lineker, and anyone who's seen Lineker fight knows that he knocked people's heads off. He's won most of his fights by stoppage, and Lineker really wasn't close to finishing Ian McCall in that fight. So I would really tend to lean against a stoppage. I think the decision is definitely the likely scenario on this one.
Francisco Rivera, Eric Perez, the only bantamweight fight here on this card. Also one of the tighter line fights. Perez, about a minus 118, minus 120 favorite out there in the market. Another one of these fights here on this card with a little bit of an age gap. Rivera, 34, Perez, 26.
Yeah, definitely has an age gap and definitely interesting. Definitely both guys like to go guns a-blazing, and I think it's going to be exciting. I don't see it going to the scorecards because just not the nature of either of these guys. I think it will be a, you know, like I said, a gunfight. I think both guys will come out striking. Perez definitely a much more crafty grappler. If he gets to the ground, he has some submission ability. But I think it's going to stay on the feet, and I think Rivera has the ability to knock out Eric Perez. Rivera a bit more reliable in the striking game, and he hits harder than Eric Perez. I think this is a primed opportunity for Francisco Rivera to get a knockout. It could do so even in round one. I would look to play the TKO prop with Francisco Rivera.
I don't want to spend too much time on this, and maybe you think that Matt Brown's a parlay piece, but he's minus 285 here against Jake Ellenberger. Do we have a live dog situation, or is the chalk probably going to hold up here?
I mean, outside of a Hail Mary shot on Matt Brown, I don't see how Jake Ellenberger wins this fight. I mean, he's just been in so many difficult fights over the years, and his body just hasn't held up. He's had difficulties in his last few fights, been a bit gun shy, and been a bit hesitant in his last few fights. And Matt Brown, you can't be hesitant against Matt Brown. Matt Brown comes at you with all sorts of weapons, elbows, kicks, punches. He's very aggressive, and he hurts people. He hits hard, comes at odd angles, and he's relentless. When he sees a finish, he goes after it. I just don't see how Jake Ellenberger survives three rounds. Probably if Ellenberger does lose that, I would say that's probably his last fight in the UFC. So I would look to play. I haven't bet it yet, but I'm definitely looking at Matt Brown by a TKO, most likely.
We've got one women's fight on the card here. Rose Namajunas against Carolina Kay. I'm not even going to try to butcher her last name because I'm sure that I'm going to. But we've had a lot of chaos in the women's bantamweight division. Not so much here in the strawweight division. Do we get an upset in this fight?
It wouldn't surprise me. Rose Namajunas has quite a bit of hype. I think it came from that original season of The Ultimate Fighter. And there were comparisons to her to Rousey just because, you know, just her mentality and her grit and her ability to finish in this weight class. But she's going to be up for it in this fight because her opponent is one of the most conditioned fighters I've ever seen in the UFC. Her volume increases every round. Her opponents slow down. She comes and she just throws strike after strike in combination. She's a difficult fighter to beat in a standing fight. She's kind of like Joanna and Jacek. They're both Polish, and they both throw with a ton of volume, and they're nonstop. It's a very difficult fight for Namajunas to game plan for. She really needs to get the fight to the ground. She may be able to do that. I think that's why the line is the way it is, because she is a bit more well-rounded because she does offer some submissions. She can definitely – she just has more tools to get to the ground, to control fighters on the ground. She's shown that in the past. And she can strike. She's long for the weight class. That definitely has an advantage. But I definitely think that Kavala Kavich is live in this case. Just the way she fights, she has pretty good striking defense as well, and she has good takedown defense. So assuming she can keep it standing for at least two of the three rounds, I think she can definitely win this fight. The hype, I think this is a case of the hype for Rose pushing this line to where it is. I don't think Carolina should be a 2-1 underdog this one.
So if Kowalkiewicz, and I guess I'll go ahead and follow your lead on that because I imagine you're pronouncing it right. If she does get the win here, I mean, are we looking at, you know, a strawweight title shot for her? Maybe, possibly, if UFC can work on the scheduling in Poland?
Yeah, I definitely think that's a potential, and that's probably what they would do. Both those fighters know each other. I think there's a little bit of, I'm not going to say bad blood, but there's definitely a little bit of a friendly rivalry. And I think that would make for a really compelling fight. It would definitely be entertaining. It would be pretty much the entire fight would be on the feet. There's a built-in storyline, and they can definitely do it in Poland if there's a Polish card sometime later this year. I definitely think this is a number one contender fight, though. The winner will absolutely be next in line for the title shot.
Well, the main event here, we've got a title fight between Robbie Lawler and Tyron Woodley. Woodley actually hasn't fought since January 31st, 2015, when he beat Kelvin Gastelum. And the thing about Woodley here for me is it feels like he's kind of really shot up this division in a hurry. I mean, certainly he deserves it. You know, pretty good fight against Rory McDonald, won that fight over Gastelum, has a win over Carlos Condit as well. So Woodley's, you know, paid his dues, but it still feels like he's kind of shot up out of nowhere to some extent.
Well, I mean, he did come from Strikeforce, and he did pretty well there. He had a win over Nate Marquardt, he lost to Nate Marquardt, rather. But, he was pretty competitive there, and he jumped over from Strikeforce, along with Robbie Lawler and some others. Tarek Safadine would be another fighter in that weight class. They all kind of shot over at the same time. And the Condit win, I think, was really the key to pushing him towards that top of the division. Most people regard Condit as the best fighter in this division or right up there with Lawler. I thought that Condit beat Lawler when they fought, so I do feel right now, but that's here nor there at this point. And he does have some other good wins. He beat Kelvin Gastelum. It was a close decision, and we just saw Kelvin Gastelum beat Johnny Hendricks, the former champion. So the wins are valid. He certainly hasn't fought in a while, like you said. It seems like he's been holding out. He's kind of been doing a bit of a Ryan Fitzpatrick, so to speak. I don't want to fight unless it's there for me. I want the title shot. I have no reason to fight before that. I think I'm the best guy, and the UFC granted him that opportunity. This fight breaks down. It's not the exact same because the game plans are a little bit different, but it's kind of similar to the UFC 200 main event with Amanda Nunes and Miesha Tate, where one fighter, in this case Tyron Woodley, has a decent shot to finish early on. He has to get him early. Tyron Woodley is is a really powerful striker, but he does tire as fights progress, kind of like Amanda Nunez does. So I think he could get him early, four rounds, but if Tyron Woodley doesn't get him in those first couple rounds, Robbie Lawler will take over in his fight. And Lawler's been awesome in the fourth and fifth rounds, particularly in the fifth. As Woodley slows down in the championship rounds, I think Lawler will turn it on and he would get a finish. So I do think this fight does go, doesn't make the scorecards. I think that's a parlay piece, actually. Fight doesn't go the distance. I think that's about around 2-1 at this point. I think that's you know, a pretty favorable bet. I would parlay that with the Matt Brown, Jake Ellenberger fight doesn't go the distance line as well, and that paid or pays rather about +105. So that's a decent bet. If you're looking for something a little more aggressive, you can look at the Tyron Woodley by KO to KO prop. I believe that's in the 3-1 range right now.
Well, it does sound like there are a lot of ways to go about it, and especially when you've got a fighter in Woodley who, you know, as you just said, a guy that tires late in fights, and he's never really gone five rounds, and certainly hasn't gone five rounds as a member of UFC. So, in fact, none of his fights have ever gone into the fifth round. He had that fight against Marquardt that ended in the fourth round about a minute and a half in. So,
yeah, and he was brutally finished in that bout, yeah. So, I mean, another way you could look at this one is if you can look to bet Woodley early, and if Lawler gets out of the first two rounds or even after the first round, there could be an opportunity to live bet Robbie Lawler, assuming he's down a round, and get a better line than, you know, the opener or the line that it currently is. So there's definitely a few different ways to play this one. It's kind of a good opportunity. It's not necessarily a straightforward fight per se, but the outcomes seem to be a bit more known than total unknowns in previous fights.
Well, Jay, I'm really glad that we were able to work out the scheduling here and get you on the show this week. I know we tried last week, weren't able to make it happen, but definitely good to get you on here for this pay-per-view event, UFC 201. But for those that are listening, you know, Jay does tremendous work over at MMAOddsBreaker.com, and I'll let him have the floor here and talk about what's going on over there.
Yeah, absolutely. I do a series of articles over at MMAOddsBreaker.com. I do scouting reports on all new fighters in the UFC, so I have up one this week on Hector Sandoval fighting Wilson Hayes, which about. I have some fighter breakdowns. I'm currently working on one on the main event with Lawler and Woodley, where I'll kind of define more of the angles that I talked about just now. And I also just started a new feature called Back to the Drawing Board, where I talk about prospects that have recently lost, and I explain why I think they lost or what they overlooked and what they need to change and, you know, how they need to progress moving forward. So it's a bit of a classroom type of initiative, and I hope folks enjoy it.
Well, like I said, you do really brilliant work over there and also brilliant work here on the show. So that's Jay Primetown of MMA Oddsbreaker at Jay Primetown on Twitter, at MMA Oddsbreaker on Twitter. Jay, appreciate your time, man. Thanks a lot. Enjoy the weekend. And we'll talk to you again real soon.
Absolutely. Take care, Adam.
Excellent insight on the PGA Championship and also UFC 201 here on today's edition of Bang the Book Radio. And, of course, got to work a little bit of baseball in there, maybe not as much as I had liked. But tomorrow is another day. And speaking of tomorrow, I'll be joined by Aaron Saunders of BangTheBook.com, also of NumberFire.com, break down the AAC for the upcoming 2016 college football season, and also chat with Jordan Bianchi of SB Nation on the motorsports action coming up here this weekend. But that'll do it for today. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.